On December 19th of 1998, Amy McGee sat in her parents' car in the parking lot in front of the police station. She was on the verge of making a huge decision that could shape the rest of her life. Earlier that evening, she had finally confided in her parents, Garth and Diana Homan, about the increasing turmoil that was taking over her world. She confessed to them that she no longer felt safe in her home. Amy was ready to leave. And Garth and Diana did what people are usually reminded to do when their child shares such intense fears with them. They believed her, and they didn't risk waiting to see if things would get better before trying to get Amy help. Though Amy was in her 30s at the time, Garth and Diana's protective nature never faltered. They took her to the police station that same night to report the abuse she had suffered through to the authorities. No matter what age she was, they were determined to do anything they could to protect their daughter.
It just goes to show that a parent's instinct to protect doesn't go away, no matter what age the child is.
Yeah. So as they sat in that car in the parking lot, Amy's mother and father tried to convince her to go into the station to tell the police everything she had told them earlier that evening. But faced with the reality of making the report, Amy was scared, and understandably so. There was no way of knowing if turning to the authorities for help would be the step that saved Amy or a move that put her in even more danger. Now, eventually, Sergeant David Malfinger went out to speak with Amy, who remained trapped by the shackles of indecision in her parents' car. Having been a friend of the family for years, Malfinger had known Amy since she was a child. But at first, the sergeant didn't even recognize the scared woman whom he found waiting in the police station parking lot. Before that night, his last memories of Amy were when she was still Amy Homan, a happy little girl who was adored by her parents, running around during a barbecue meant to bring people together, lovingly scolded by her father for being a bit too rambunctious. That night, Amy's demeanor was a stark contrast when compared to the carefree child he would later tell a reporter about. She shared her dark secrets of what had been going on behind closed doors with Officer Malfinger. A little girl grew up to discover that the man she had fallen in love with was an abuser. Unfortunately, it's all too common for victims of abuse to be ignored, their suffering minimized, perpetrators protected, with some victims even being accused of lying about the abuse they've been subjected to. In fact, a report released by the United States Department of Justice stated that of the 2.1 million incidents of family violence that were reported to police between 1998 and 2002, only 36% resulted in an arrest.
And that stat alone tells you that we're not doing enough.
Right. Now, getting law enforcement involved is typically the best option victims have for escaping abusive situations. Yet true consequences for perpetrators of abuse is far from guaranteed. In Amy's case, her report was taken seriously. With the help and support of her parents and Officer Malfinger, Amy received an emergency protective order that called for her abuser to relinquish his weapons, leave their shared residence, and barred him from having direct contact with Amy until there was a hearing or a continued order. With things moving in the right direction, Amy's story should be one that we can share to point out the best ways to act quickly when someone admits to being abused, get help for victims of abuse, and provide enduring support for victims throughout the whole heartbreaking legal process. Sadly, Amy's story isn't so neatly wrapped up with a happy ending. Instead of serving as a model for successful escape and healing, just 6 years after Amy found herself in that parking lot in front of the police station with her parents, her story would be analyzed by professionals as they tried to pinpoint what exactly went wrong.
And it's hard not to wonder exactly what went wrong, given all of the steps that she took.
Right. How did Amy's life take such a tragic turn? Even as so many people seemed to be aware of the increasingly serious danger she was in. Hey, Crime Sal listeners. So today, we will be sharing Amy Diane Homan McGee's story, a young mother who suffered through years of domestic violence inflicted upon her by her husband, Vincent McGee. Her case and all the missed opportunities for a happier ending was tragic enough to spark an in-depth investigation led by State College Police Department Detective Deirdre Fischel. Instead of making excuses as to why authorities didn't do more to help Amy, Detective Deirdre Fischel dared question how Amy's story could have possibly ended in tragedy when so many people were aware of what was going on in her home, including law enforcement and medical professionals.
And these are the type of investigators that we need, the ones that are willing to ask the hard questions, even after the fact.
And by going over the details of the case and speaking to Amy's friends and family members and coworkers, Fischel exposed harsh truths about the reality of domestic violence. This investigation provided valuable insight into the issue of domestic abuse, which was shared in a documentary called Telling Amy's Story by Penn State Public Broadcasting, hosted by actress and activist Mariska Hargitay, best known for her role as Detective Olivia Benson on Law & Order SVU. This case is a sad one, so before we go any further, we must warn you that this episode includes discussions of domestic violence and abuse of all types, including sexual abuse and intimate partner murders. If any of these topics are sensitive for you, you may want to skip this episode and tune in next week instead.
And with that being said, please take care of yourself first. Your well-being always comes before the story.
Right. For now, let's turn back to Amy McGee and her story of strength, love, and ultimately, tragedy. Amy Homan was born February 15, 1968, the only child of Garth and Diana Homan. Raised in State College, Pennsylvania, Amy grew up in a community that was known for being relatively safe, or at least that's how it appeared to be on the surface. While discussing the case, Detective Deirdre Fischel, who works for the Bureau of State College, explained that a lot of the violent crime she has come across in the area during her career in law enforcement has occurred within households, stating in her interview, quote, "In the last 2 years, my unit has handled over 500 cases of domestic violence, and for a couple of years, all of our homicides in Center County were domestic violence related."
And what's shocking about this is it's not just an isolated case. I mean, this is a pattern.
Right. Especially considering that statistics show that when women are murdered, the perpetrator is most likely to be someone incredibly close to them. A report released by the UN found that out of the 87,000 women from around the world who were murdered in 2017, 58% of them were killed by intimate partners or family members, with more than a third having been killed by their current or former intimate partner. In the United States, 63% of women who are murdered are killed by current or former romantic partners. Nearly three women are killed by an intimate partner every single day. With this in mind, it can be easy to reflect on cases such as Amy's and point out warning signs that seem to be obvious from an outsider's perspective. But as we all live our everyday lives, most people don't think about the very real possibility that someone they know and love could be victims of domestic violence, let alone themselves.
And I think there's a few reasons for this, but ultimately, I think it comes down to nobody wants to believe that the person they love would be capable of doing something like this or would even consider it.
Right. Viewed in this light, when Vincent and Amy began dating in 1997, when Amy was 29 years old, the fact that Vincent was always bringing Amy to work, picking her up at the end of her long shift, checking in to see how she was doing and doing everything he could do to spend time with her was seen as romantic. Hints of obsession were chalked up as typical of that new love honeymoon stage where couples want nothing more than to spend all of their time together.
And we hear this type of thing all the time, especially at the beginning of a relationship. Oh, he just loves me so much. He's a little controlling, but that's okay. He really likes me. He wants to spend time with me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really hard, especially at the beginning of relationships, to identify that. Like, what is controlling? What is infatuation? It's really hard to identify if someone is sinister.
Right. And it didn't take long for more prominent signs to start signaling that something wasn't quite right with Amy and Vincent's relationship. Cracks started to show at the very place that Amy met Vincent McGee, the home improvement store where she worked. So after being discharged from the military, Vincent had gotten a job working for an armored car service, which just happened to be responsible for the money pickup and drop-off services at the store where Amy was working. In September of 1997, a letter was sent from the store to the armored car service Vincent worked for, requesting that Vincent no longer be tasked with deliveries to the home improvement store. It turns out that Amy's coworkers had noticed that whenever Vincent showed up at the store, Amy would become stressed, likely due to Vincent's already apparent controlling nature and extreme jealousy. While Vincent was there, Amy had to worry about upsetting him by doing simple, everyday work tasks, such as talking to a male coworker or customer, interfering with her workday.
It seems like even early on in the relationship, he was already trying to isolate and control her.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this pattern repeated itself throughout Amy and Vincent's relationship. No matter where Amy worked and behind closed doors, Vincent's behavior towards Amy was escalating into even more dangerous forms of abuse. Amy began to fear Vincent, something she kept mostly hidden until that day in December of 1998. By then, Amy and Vincent were married with a young child in the house, yet that didn't seem to deter Vincent's violence. Amy would later explain that Vincent had been drinking throughout most of the day and breaking things around the house. She also said that Vincent threatened to kill her if she took his kid away from him. That night, Amy reached out to her parents for help, telling them about Vincent's problems with alcohol and abusive behavior. That's how she found herself in the parking lot of the police department, recounting the warning signs that had morphed into full-blown sirens by then.
It's heartbreaking that it took a direct death threat for her to say something. Like, that shows you how deep this fear runs.
Yeah. Now, after Amy was granted the emergency protective order, officers, they went to the couple's house to collect Vincent's guns. While the officers were at the house, Vincent started calling Amy and harassing her, telling her that he had another gun that the officers hadn't found, and threatening to kill himself with it. And officers hadn't even left the property yet, and Vincent had already violated the terms of the emergency protective order.
And that's how fragile these protective orders are. I mean, it's a piece of paper. It's not some magical shield. It's still scary. It still doesn't keep you safe.
And on top of that, since this happened over the weekend, the emergency protective order was due to expire that following Monday, leaving Amy completely unprotected unless she requested additional protection. Moments like these can prove to be pivotal for women who are trying to leave abusive relationships. In one study done on 150 women who applied for protective orders, 40 women dropped the protection order before their court date, most often because they either went back to their abuser or they believed that the time-consuming process was too much of a hassle or inconvenient. Many of these women reported dropping the protective order within the first 2 weeks. When you think about it, how busy most of us are just in our normal lives, it makes sense that these women, many who I imagine have families, children, jobs, and a whole range of other responsibilities to take care of, were already so drained by the abuse and unable to find the time or energy to go through the lengthy legal process.
It's almost as if you're trying to leave a house that's on fire. Like, you need to get out of this house. It's burning down. But there's so many hoops that you have to jump through and paperwork that you have to fill out. It's not that easy of a task.
Yeah, that's exactly what it seems like. And maybe being so overloaded with life is one of the many complex reasons that it takes women, on average, 7 attempts to leave an abusive relationship before they finally escape for good. Now, Amy took a very big, important step that following Monday, though. On December 21st, 1998, Amy requested additional protection. She bravely outlined the months of abuse that had led her to this point, recalling painful memories of Vincent choking her, pulling their baby out of her arms, and threatening to burn the house down, along with other instances of abuse. This was especially huge considering how long Amy had tried to hide the evidence of Vincent's abuse, coming up with excuses to explain away bruises noticed by concerned coworkers and family members.
And not to keep this analogy going, but you can almost feel her trying to climb out of it, like one step at a time.
Yeah, it's so sad. And we must circle back to that daunting statistic. It typically takes victims an average of 7 attempts before they leave their abuser for good. On December 28th, just a week after sharing the many ways Vincent had abused her, Amy stood by Vincent's side as the couple asked the judge to drop the order of protection and give Vincent his guns back. Their request was granted. And in 1999, the couple moved to Uniontown, bringing them closer to Vincent's family while creating physical distance with Amy's family. The abuse seems to have escalated, as is often the case in domestic violence situations, with Vincent going so far as to discharge his handgun into the passenger side window of the very car his wife and child were sitting in during a heated argument.
Discharge? So he shot through the passenger side window?
Yeah.
With his wife and child in the car? If that's not a red flag, like, I don't know what is.
It's terrifying to even think about. Statistics show him owning a gun makes him 5 times more likely to kill her.
Exactly. And I know this might piss a lot of people off to hear, but I mean, these are the facts.
When an abuser takes things to that dangerous level, using a gun to threaten or assault their partner, their victim's risk of being killed jumps up 20 times higher. This incident occurred on what was supposed to be Amy's first day at her new job. Despite this, Amy was allowed to start her new position at the phone store where she made connections with her coworkers. While building these connections, it seems that her coworkers' care grew alongside their concerns.
And this is where community really starts to matter. I mean, these coworkers might have been her first safety net.
Exactly. Vincent was getting bolder in the ways that he controlled, intimidated, and lashed out at Amy. Though Amy's job technically granted her time away from her increasingly violent husband, Vincent refused his grasp on Amy, not even allowing her to do her job to the best of her ability. Amy had to report to Vincent each day when she started her lunch break, and she wasn't allowed to work alone with male coworkers. Days of missing work due to complications with Vincent were noticed by her coworkers, but even more disruptive were Vincent's obsessive, frequent calls to Amy during her workday. He even started calling the store directly to check up on her, putting her job at risk.
It's insane, honestly.
In April of 2001, Amy gave birth to the couple's second child, which didn't seem to soften Vincent at all. Just a couple of months later, Amy tried to leave Vincent again. Police officers intervening to allow Amy and her 2 children to safely flee to her parents' house in State College. And by August of that year, Uniontown police officers where Amy admitted that her husband had punched her during an argument, resulting in her broken nose. Instead of arresting Vincent, the officers left Amy with information on protective orders and told her to call them if the abuse continued. This lack of true assistance by law enforcement officers is, unfortunately, a common hurdle victims face when seeking help to escape their abuser.
I mean, how many red flags does it take before someone steps in? The protection order obviously isn't working at this point. I just feel bad for her.
Yeah, it seems like more needs to be done than just a piece of paper.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tantandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Detective Fischel empathizes deeply with victims, sharing that she never talks about victims who won't testify, referring to Amy as being not able to testify instead. Fischel explains, if we could guarantee a victim that they would be safe, that the outcome of the court case would be better for them, then I believe that a victim would testify, but we can't guarantee that. Regardless of the risks, Amy didn't give up. She requested an emergency transfer from the store she worked at in Uniontown to the previous store she had worked at in State College, intending to escape Vincent's abuse and flee to safety by living with her parents. But life doesn't always go as planned. Amy and her children did make the move to State College, but they didn't move there alone. Vincent followed them there. Vincent's controlling behavior towards Amy wasn't getting any better. Amy's coworkers, empathetic to her situation, posted fake work schedules so Vincent wouldn't get mad about her working with male coworkers, concerned by the bruises that Amy insisted weren't from her husband.
And that right there tells you everything about this case. The fact that her coworkers had to come together to keep her safe, basically spoofing a schedule to show that she wasn't working with a male coworker. The level of control there is just out of this world.
Yeah. Now, one of Amy's old coworkers explained, quote, "You can't force a person that's being abused to come forward. One, because they're scared. Two, because they have no self-esteem. And three, they don't know if other people are going to believe what they're saying." This particular coworker could relate to Amy's pain, having recently left her abusive husband after 21 years of marriage at the time. She shared her story with Amy, explaining, "I wanted her to experience the happiness I felt, believe it or not, the morning I left." As Amy grew closer to her coworkers, she began to reveal some of the lies she had told to protect Vincent, confiding in her coworkers about Vincent's drinking and eventually admitting that her husband was physically abusing her. By about the middle of October, Amy started to brainstorm ways to escape Vincent's abuse for good. She requested another transfer, this time back to the store in Uniontown, but her request was denied, allowing the tension in the household to reach a boiling point on November 8th of 2001. Amy was immediately on high alert on the morning of November 8th of 2001 after Vincent did something completely out of the ordinary. He agreed to let her use their truck to drive herself to work, which this was unusual. Amy, she probably felt like this was off, you know? He always drove her to work. That's just how it was. And she was worried that something was wrong. Amy called her mother partway through her shift and asked her to check in on the children. Diana agreed. She went over to the house only to find Vincent asleep, totally ignoring the needs of his two young sons, claiming to be too tired to take care of them. Diana offered to take her grandsons for the day, something Vincent agreed to. Yet it seems with the children gone, Vincent, he got this burst of energy because instead of falling back to sleep and getting some rest that he desperately needed, he started harassing Amy, who was still at work, calling the store so many times that the employees stopped picking up the phone. Infuriated by being ignored, Vincent walked to the phone store where he harassed Amy and her coworkers in person before finally leaving with the truck.
Okay, so he's too tired to take care of the kids, but he's not tired enough to walk to the phone store to harass Amy.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Vincent, he returned to the store later that day to pick Amy up after her shift, but Amy was already gone, enjoying dinner with her parents and sons. And as you can imagine, this ticked off Vincent. He couldn't have this. He found the family at a restaurant, and he walked right in, to confront Amy, who, at that point, had finally had enough. Amy told Vincent that she couldn't do this anymore. Vincent had until tomorrow to get all of his things out of the house. In the meantime, she and the boys would be staying with her parents. Vincent, he stormed out of the restaurant. And before going back to her parents' house, Amy asked if they could stop by her house to grab a few things, supplies that she would need for the children for their overnight visit. Her parents agreed, staying in the car with the boys while Amy went inside, unaware of the danger waiting to steal their daughter's life.
And this is just one small stop, maybe 5 minutes to get some things. But they didn't know that Vincent was even at the house. I think he had parked his truck in the garage, so they thought it was just an empty house. No big deal.
And it wasn't even 5 minutes later. The door opened. Someone stepped outside, but it wasn't Amy. It was Vincent. A predator hiding in the shadows, his chilling words would completely change the Homan family's lives forever. Someone called 911. I just shot Amy.
Jesus. I even knew it was coming, and it just still knocks the wind out of you when you hear it.
By the time State College police officers arrived, it was too late. They found Vincent slumped over Amy's lifeless body, lying on the living room floor. Vincent had shot his wife in the top of her head at point-blank range. The 33-year-old mother of two had died instantly. 37-year-old Vincent was arrested and taken to Center County Prison in Bellefonte, charged with one count, each of first-degree murder, third-degree murder, and involuntary manslaughter. He is currently serving a life sentence for the murder of Amy McGee, a mother taken from her children long before she should have left this earth. A daughter, a friend, ripped away from her loved ones. An intelligent, hardworking woman's bright future was cut short due to one man's uncontrolled anger, jealousy, and possessiveness.
It's such a sad story. And what's sad here is this type of violence, it isn't isolated to just Amy. This type of thing happens all the time.
Alarming statistics warn of the prevalence of intimate partner violence, with the CDC revealing that over 10 million people are subjected to intimate partner violence every single year. Domestic abuse is known to escalate, sometimes only stopped when it reaches that point of no return. Data from U.S. crime reports found that about 1 in 5 homicide victims are killed by an intimate partner.
So with that statistic, that means that somebody listening right now probably knows a victim or is one.
Yeah. Now, these numbers are a bit terrifying to come to terms with, or at least that's how I felt while I was researching this topic. However, death at the hands of an intimate partner is often preceded by warning signs that are important to take seriously to prevent more tragedies like the murder of Amy McGee from happening. Studies show that 67 to 80% of intimate partner homicides involved a male partner physically abusing the female partner before the murder occurred, regardless of which partner was killed. And about 40% of victims who have been murdered by their abusers sought help at some point during the 2 years leading up to their death. Women between the ages of 16 through 24 are most likely to be abused by an intimate partner. But despite this, it's been reported that 57% of college students, many who are in or near that age range, have admitted that it's difficult to identify dating abuse. And around the same percentage of students shared that even if they could identify dating abuse, they wouldn't know how to help a victim of it. And 38% admitted they wouldn't even know how to get help for themselves if they became victims. So, statistics like this show, it wouldn't hurt to incorporate conversations of domestic violence abuse in schools, you know, during health class.
I mean, I completely agree.
This is one of the many reasons why spreading awareness of this difficult yet incredibly important topic is essential to protecting vulnerable victims who may not even realize the full extent of the danger that they're in. The first step is ensuring that everyone is informed of what counts as domestic violence and the signs that someone you know may be being abused. On their website, the United Nations defines domestic abuse as a pattern of behavior in any relationship that is used to gain or maintain power and control over an intimate partner. Abuse is physical, sexual, emotional, economic, or psychological actions or threats of actions that influence another person. This includes any behaviors that frighten, intimidate, terrorize, manipulate, hurt, humiliate, blame, injure, or wound someone. There are many different types of domestic abuse and a variety of ways that it can manifest. Refuge, the largest domestic abuse organization in the UK, narrows down 6 categories of abuse: psychological, emotional abuse, name-calling, threats, manipulation, and gaslighting, coercive control, a pattern of behavior used to dominate or restrict a partner's freedom. Physical abuse includes hitting, restraining, throwing objects, pinching, or shoving. Sometimes it's brushed off as a joke. Tech abuse, using technology to stalk victims, send abusive messages, demand access to devices, or share private images. Economic abuse, controlling access to money or resources, preventing a partner from working or placing them in debt. Sexual abuse includes both physical and non-physical acts, such as manipulation or coercion into unwanted sexual activity. To help victims and their loved ones better understand if what they're experiencing is considered abuse, many online resources offer self-assessment questions. We've gathered a list of questions to share with our listeners today to give everyone an idea of what to look for. Sometimes it can help to ask, does your partner push, hit, kick, bite, or throw things at you? Constantly question you, your decisions, or put you down? Constantly criticize you and your abilities as a partner, parent, or employee? Become extremely jealous? Threaten to hurt you, your children, pets, family members, and friends, or themselves? Destroy personal property? Push for you to be financially dependent on them while controlling access to resources like the car, bank accounts, and credit cards? Intimidate or manipulate you or your children? Humiliate you in front of others? Try to control where you go, what you wear, and who you spend time with? Pressure you to have sex when you don't want to? Control your access to medicine or care that you need? Now, keep in mind that this list is not all inclusive. If you or someone you love has suspicions about being trapped in an abusive relationship, chances are something isn't right in that dynamic. It's important to stay safe and protect yourself, possibly even reach out to authorities, because all signs of abuse should be taken seriously. If you need guidance through this difficult process, the National Domestic Violence Hotline can be a great place to start. By going on their website, you can find fantastic resources such as how to create a safety plan, legal information, how to support others, and how to identify signs of abuse. Their website also offers a directory of domestic violence service providers who can help with emergency shelter, counseling, financial aid, legal advocacy. You can contact the hotline to connect with a live advocate 24/7 by using their live chat feature or calling 1-800-799-7233. Or you can even text START to 88788. And another helpful organization I personally learned about while researching this case is the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs Intimate Partner Violence Assistance Program. This program is meant to help veterans and their partners who are impacted by intimate partner violence. Though more research needs to be done on this topic, studies seem to suggest that veterans may be more impacted by cases of intimate partner violence than the general public, particularly veterans who suffer from PTSD. And there are many reasons why this may be the case, including more frequent exposure to trauma, higher rates of depression and substance abuse, and even physical brain injuries received during combat. Traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs, are known to sometimes cause people to become more erratic, depressed, and aggressive, among other personality changes that can contribute to abusers becoming violent. And victims of domestic abuse are also at risk of suffering from a TBI due to physical violence inflicted upon them. It's been reported that over 75% of domestic violence survivors suffer from single or repeated traumatic brain injuries, which in some cases can play a part in allowing the cycle of abuse to continue. Of course, none of this justifies a violent murderer's actions. Rather, I believe it's important to be aware of risk factors that could lead to someone either becoming a victim or a perpetrator of domestic violence. Some patterns have been found among abusers, traits worth paying attention to. These commonly include consuming drugs or large amounts of alcohol, controlling daily activities, being possessive, jealous, or paranoid, low self-esteem, and emotional dependence, often mutual between both partners, though more dominant in the abuser. Amy McGee's story, littered with so many warning signs, steps forward, and a clear timeline of escalating violence is the perfect case study for what victims of domestic violence often go through at the hands of their abusers. Unfortunately, the steps taken to try to protect Amy from her abuser ultimately failed to give her the happy ending she and her children so deserved. But maybe we can all learn from the mistakes made leading up to Amy's heartbreaking fate and use this knowledge to help victims who remain trapped in that awful cycle of violence. Please share today's episode on social media and leave a comment to share your thoughts on how we can all better support victims of domestic violence. As always, we're so grateful for our Crime Salad Patreon and Apple subscribers. Your support means the world to us, and it helps us play our part in continuing these difficult but impactful conversations. We can't change what happened to Amy, but we can keep talking about it. That's how we start to change what happens next. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We're grateful for this chance to dive into these important topics as we do our best to lend our voice to those who have been unfairly silenced. Stay safe, take care of yourselves, and we'll catch you next week for another deep dive into the stories that need to be told.